the Danielle Strickland Podcast. We're glad you're here. For more information on what Danielle does, go to daniellestrickland.com.
Welcome, everybody, to a new episode with Danielle Strickland and...
And with James Shaw.
Yes, my husband wanted to make sure that you were properly introduced.
Yeah, so hey everyone, my name's James Shaw. As I say, I've been with Danielle for a couple of seasons and we're halfway through this one. So if you've stuck with me for this long, I'm very pleased that... And that's, we haven't got any reviews saying like we need less of that guy.
Not yet, but if you have that review...
This could be the final one I'm on. So this is my last podcast. It's been a blast. Thanks for having me.
And also, it's so funny. If you just wondered what this disembodied voice, who this English male voice is, his name's James Scholl. He's a friend and a part of the team here. And anyway... We're excited to be back with this episode of Mind Blowing Books We Love and Hate. It's complicated. And we're still in current profits.
We really got stuck here for a while, didn't we?
Yeah, we're going to finish this section up and then we're going to move on. So this is going to be our last one. So we're going to squeeze a few in here and a couple maybe honorable mentions as well that we don't have time to kind of go through the quotes, but we think are worthy of mentioning. And I have had a lot of feedback, James, from people going like, can you stop mentioning books? Because I have a long list now of things I have to read. So no, I cannot. I cannot stop.
All the people that look to the side of their bed and have that pile of books, right. It's getting increasingly...
It's like, I have to order a new book every week. And then I'm just like, well, just read it. It'll be good.
This is why I tell people to read short books. That's why I'm right. Very generous in my recommendations.
Yeah, so they're going to like you better than me. But here's the other thing is 2022 could be the book year. It could be your book year. Less TV, more books.
I mean, that does sound like a good idea.
Yeah, although I am going to review some TV shows. But anyway, okay.
TV's really good right now.
I know, the long arc. There's just something, this long story. I just think, anyway, I digress. Current prophet number one, Anne Lamott, the one and the only.
Yo, tell us a little bit more about Anne Lamott, Danielle, because you're pretty hype on Anne Lamott. And
well, okay, so we mentioned Frederick Buechner last time, and people say that Anne Lamott's kind of filling the void of Frederick Buechner in some ways, except that I would say she's a little bit more accessible to a lot more people. So the reason why I put her in the prophet category really is because I think she has a prophetic voice, but she's a prophet that is not speaking inwardly to the people of the church or the people. She's actually a prophet who's speaking outwardly to the culture. So there's some really beautiful things. So if you don't know Anne Lamott, I'd recommend Traveling Mercies. That's kind of like her first big book about her own life. And you'll get like her style is pretty irreverent, but also very... sacred, like very holy, but also she just tells the truth. And she's very open with her own journey through the 12 step, through AA and sort of getting sober. And I find people in those communities pretty good truth tellers. So she kind of calls it like it is. She is an accomplished writer. So there's another, like, so Traveling Mercies is a really good idea. Her latest book, which I listened to on Audible, which is regretful in some ways because I don't have those quotes in a book that I can quote from right now. It's all just like happened in my head.
We've relied quite heavily on those as Danielle scrolls through a book at the last minute trying to draw something for this.
Well, I got it all drawn up in there. It's just got to find them. But I listened to it and I was telling James, like I laughed out loud. I think I might have cried at one point. Listening to her book, and I had a long drive, so I listened to it all at once, and it was just like therapy for my soul. It was just always, I feel glad I read Anne Lamott. That's what happens. She also has a training thing called Bird by Bird. That's one of her books, Bird by Bird, on writing. And there's a training thing she does for writers, and it's hilarious. If you can get a hold of that, I'm sure you can. Just Google it. It'll come up somewhere. It's like a course that you can get, and it's hours and hours and hours of her teaching writing, and it's absolutely fantastic. She's just so refreshing. She also has a TED Talk that's pretty popular, 10 Things I Know for Sure, and it's well worth a watch, like 10 minutes or something. It's well worth a watch. So those are a few of my Anne Lamott favorites, and I'm just going to give you a couple of – we've had some pretty heavy – heavy-hitting theological gems and more coming. More coming.
If you're not interested in 50-year-old Latin American theology, then...
Yeah, and men who have to make it all long and complicated. You can hear a woman who can just say it. when it takes two paragraphs for a guy to say and can say in a sentence. But anyway, here's a couple of good quotes from Anne just for your own edification.
This one's huge for me, and I didn't realize it was Anne Lamott. I had heard of the quote, but I didn't realize it was her that had said it. But she says, "You can safely assume you've created God in your own image when it turns out that God hates all the same people that you do." And it's just, oh, there's probably people listening and just being like, oh, it hurts a little bit. Like, that's just, it's so close to home. Yeah. She cuts so close, right?
And actually, that's one of her styles that I think is so winsome is that she's also talking about herself. So most of her books are self-depreciating like that. But what happens is because she's vulnerable enough to say those things, she invites you in. And all of a sudden you find yourself agreeing with her about you too. And so it's such a beautiful technique of allowing truth to change us. It's just a really good posture.
That's an impressive balance to strike as well, because I think there's some people that don't go quite far enough in their self-deprecation and they sound kind of stuck up and like they're just giving advice without having lived anything. And then there's people that go maybe too far the other way. And again, like maybe oversharing is the wrong term, but I'm now feeling sorry for you rather than wanting to kind of be changed by what you're saying. And I think threading that needle, as she clearly does, I think is a really impressive skill and something that we all benefit from. As you say, it's invitational as well as being completely authentic and reflective of who she is.
Yeah, and I think as a communicator, as communicators and preachers and stuff, we have a lot to learn. I would recommend you reading and just for that. Just to learn how to communicate truth in such a way that it leaves you open rather than closes you in defense. So she just has such a, and this next quote by her talks about this. So she says, "You don't always have to chop with the sword of truth. You can paint with it too." And I think that's literally what we're talking about, is she has this capacity to paint, and the painting is beheld instead of just this damage that you do to people as you spill out on them. All right, a couple more.
All right, I like this one too. She says, "You can either practice being right or you can practice being kind." And how much is that? I realize probably a lot of folks listening to maybe are Christian or have been Christian or are in some sort of stage of that journey. And it so often feels like we're forced to pick one.
Right.
It's like, well, you can have truth or you can get out kind of thing. Like, well, wait, what? There's even being forced to choose between, say, truth and love, for example. Like, well, that seems like an interesting dichotomy that you're forcing upon me.
Wait, this is a trick.
Yeah.
What is this called? My son's been doing this to me in chess. He just figured out how to do this. So in chess, where you move the guy and then you have this choice that you lose one piece or the other.
Forking you.
Forking you. Yeah. So that's kind of, that's like a fork. Yeah, that's a Christian fork. Like, truth or love, what will it be? And you're like,
I have to pick one.
I'm going to die here. Yes, someone's dying here. Here's another one. The difference between, this one's fun and it gets a little bit to her sense of humor, but the difference between you and God is that God doesn't think he's you. And I feel like enough is said on that one. Another one, this is from her writing workshop. And the question was raised, like, what if you have someone in your family that's like been bad to you and you're trying to write about it, but you're like scared because of what they might think. And so this is a quote from that. She says, "You own everything that happened to you. Tell your stories. If people wanted you to write warmly about them, they should have behaved better." It's one of my favorites. And again, you see like her centering people every time, like centering the story, like centering the person rather than giving space and time for things that we just spend way too much giving space and time to. It's beautiful.
So how do you think about that when you're writing as well? That's something that I guess I'm kind of interested by, sort of your process there too.
Well, the other thing that's really funny is that she also said she changes enough details, like minor details, like maybe, you know, their height or their, you know, so in the descriptions, they don't look like them.
Okay.
She said, but like literally sometimes she'll write about them verbatim. Like this is literally what they said at a birthday party. Like, so the events are exactly the same, except the character is like a different size or different sex. And she says they never recognize themselves. And I think that's hilarious because she's like, it's so funny. Like people do not want to associate with a different, with a bad character. Mm. So even if they're the bad character, they're disassociated enough not to recognize
it. I'm so sorry that happened to you.
That's like, right.
Well, that guy sounds like a jerk.
And she actually says that, like, that guy was a real, and she's just like looking at her going, that guy was you. And, you know, like, and so that's a really interesting thing. So she has a few tips like that, like just change some of the characters or names, which of course, I do a fair bit of that. I do a lot of disguising for just protecting people's identity or families of members who, you know, like there's just some wisdom in not throwing everybody under the bus, but telling the truth, like don't sacrifice the truth for the sake of some person that doesn't deserve it.
I think that's, and what she says there is so empowering as well, right? As you say, like, you own everything that happened to you. Even that, there's a real empowerment within it. And and sadly, we live in a time where not everyone is as great to one another as they should be. But saying like, no, that's yours now. And you, and again, whilst I want to be, we don't want to stray into kind of victim blaming, but to say like, no, actually you have power here as well now. Mm-hmm. I think that's a beautiful, and that can be part of a redemption of so many cruel things that are done to people. And say like, actually, no, you own that now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's really important too. And I think we've learned that over the last couple of years of like people handling, you know, accusations or sexual harassment or, you know, women, the Me Too movement kind of finally speaking up and people disbelieving them. And like, you know, in the media or even in the court system, they always come out scathed, you know, like they come out wounded more. And you just think, what is wrong with people? Like, this is their, like they should be champions of truth, right? Like they're whistleblowers in the best possible way.
Yeah.
So centering their voices. And I think, yeah, that's a beautiful thing. And I think because Anne Lamott has shared vulnerably about things that are difficult in her own life circumstances and being a single mom and her mess ups and drunkenness and AA, like, you know, she's really just kind of opened her life up. And I think that affords her a little bit more credibility too, to say like, you own this, I own this, we're allowed to speak our truth. So it's good. And then fun. This is one of my favorite, and I like it. The way I saw this quote was actually of a, like of a picture of a little kid just killing themselves laughing. And it says, laughter is carbonated holiness. And I love this idea because, I mean, I've grown up in sort of a religious background where holiness was always like, I don't know, just like boring and austere, like something like it was like, held in high, like you had to dress up for it and keep silent in it, you know, like all these kind of things. I love this idea of just like joy and the expression of joy and laughter being God's presence released in the world. I think there's something so profound about that.
It, as you say, it's really interesting that that's our kind of, that's our impression, or that's how we think we should be. We occasionally joke around in church here if people are having a really fun time, we're like, hey, settle down guys, this is a church. And whilst it's said as a joke, it it's a joke because it resonates on some level,
right?
Because people go like, oh yeah, oh wait, are we allowed to do that, or is that okay? For me, joy is one of the fruits of the spirit. So
there should be more.
It's like
it.
Really early, actually. It's like the second one. And well, so if there's no joy, then what is the spirit doing there?
Yeah, and it's strength too. And that, I think that's one of the things, like I said, her last book really moved me. Like I cried, but I also laughed a lot.
Mm.
And I think there's something, I think we need to laugh a little bit more, James. I need to laugh more. So, and I have like my youngest son is the epitome of joy. Like he is constantly happy, always fits of laughter. Like he's just hilarious. The kid's hilarious. And I just need, I like, even when he's doing it, I try to enter in as much as I can, even though like my adult sense is like, oh, get it together. Like we're trying to eat dinner here, you know? And he's just like on the ground and I'm just like, no, be on the ground, man. Like, let this go. Like, this is funny. You're funny. I love you. Joy is good.
What is not beautiful about this?
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. This is carbonated holiness, guys. We're in the presence of God. I just think we need to laugh a lot more. This is my medicine for today. Laugh more. Read Anne Lamott and laugh. Throw your head back and laugh. It's funny.
There is definitely something that I think if you were doing a kind of word association with Christianity or church, or how far would you have to go down to find laughter? Is it in the top 100? Does it crack?
Well,
the
isn't
top
that what they say about G.K. Chesterton, who didn't crack this list, which is shocking? But that they say he was the funnest, most joyful guy ever.
Is that right?
Did you hear that? I heard that. Really, I think I read like a My Hero book by Philip Yancey, where he does these deep dives into people. And he said G.K. Chesterton, was known as just like the life of the party. And he was always laughing. And then you think, like, here's a guy who wrote like some seriously deep theological truth, but he got there through joy, which, come on. Three cheers for joy.
I'm pretty sure that Jesus was pretty joyful, right? And I mean, maybe we miss that because the... Even the Gospels are written. The point isn't to say how Jesus is feeling in a lot of these moments, even though we do see this expression out of him. But this idea that he wouldn't be joyful in all of these situations where he's like, he's having a meal with his friend. Like, so do you have this idea of like a stone-faced Jesus, like looking
around? That's what I love about that's what I really love about the Chosen series. Okay. Which I think you still haven't watched.
No,
is that correct?
On,
I'm going to shame you for this
just
forever.
Keep on getting told off for this.
Watch it. Okay. Because the description of Jesus, the way Jesus is portrayed in that film, is really life-giving and joyful and like open. And it's really, I think the actor does a really good job at portraying Jesus. But anyway, I digress. Anne Lamott, guys, joy is good. Check her out. Laugh more. And we're going to talk about this later, but more novels too. Like, just enjoy life. Like, get, you know, anyway, get into it. Get into the mystery. Okay, prophet, current prophet. Here we go. This is our last official, like, where we're going to read quotes. And then I'm just going to name a couple because I think they're important to name. Okay, this one is Richard Twiss. And his name actually means he stands with his people. He died in 2013, which was a real tragedy. I know many people who were deeply close friends with him, and they took it very hard. I mean, it was just, it was too early for him to go. But he was the founder of Wakoni International, co-founder of NAITS, North American Institute for Indigenous Theological Studies, and a co-founder of Evangelicals for Justice. So he's a doctorate, you know, I guess I should say Dr. Richard Twiss in missiology from Asbury Theological Seminary. He wrote a book called One Church, Many Tribes. But this is the book that I'm talking about now, and it's called Rescuing the Gospel from the Cowboys, a Native American Expression of the Jesus Way. Now, this book is pretty deep. Like, I would say this probably is what people are reading at seminary and stuff. Like, it's a very, very deep book. So I read it really, really slowly. But it does a really good job at some of the history, telling the historical, not just like the historical record of like what happened historically, but the theological history of how it happened. And I really, really appreciate that. So, for example, here's one. He asks this question. He says, what hindered or prevented the early missionaries from contextualizing the gospel? And what still hinders Anglo-Christian workers and missionaries from contextualizing on our reservations today? I contend a major reason is the hegemony, and that's power structure, of Western culturally informed theologies that remain intact within religious institutions and structures. They have a commitment to produce results. There's a functional pragmatism connected to the gospel that results in the need for quantifiable conversions, economic viability, and church growth in ways that make sense to them culturally, or they might say biblically. A man recently said to me that his organization supported a worker who was able to show them a convert-to-dollar ratio or track record. We're entering the era of post-colonial Christianity. This is making it possible for young leaders to experience wisdom, empowerment, and knowledge resulting from increased cultural integrity, access to the emerging global hermeneutical community, and a reframed narrative for life in Christ as an indigenous story among indigenous people. It's as I heard a man say from an indigenous framework, wisdom is knowledge experienced relationally. So that's a lot. See what I mean? It's deep and it's really, really thick. But I think the idea of the colonization of indigenous peoples in North America. I mean, we've seen the results of this and we're going to continue to see the results of this because it was really a long-term thing that we've done and continue to do. And that's what he says. Why do we continue not to be able? So he's really wrestling through this idea of like, we went into other cultures around the world and we're able to contextualize the gospel better. But then when it came to indigenous cultures where we were not, as a matter of fact, we did the exact opposite. We were like, your religion's bad. It's paganism, it's evil, it's demonic, and it has to go. And literally, like, we're going to beat it out of you and starve it out of you and kill it out of you. And that's like Canadian policy, right? Like kill the Indian and the child was the whole residential school strategy. So, and he's sort of saying like, how do we go to China and say like, we've got to contextualize the gospel here. Like how do we, these mission organizations go to like India and say, okay, how do we contextualize the gospel here and not be able to do it here on reservations and stuff? So I think that's interesting that it's like we went for pragmatic, we go for functional, our value system is completely different. So, you know.
His focus on relationship, I think, is wonderful and weirdly kind of countercultural to Christianity. You know, how am I having a cell relationship all of a sudden? Like, what right. a curious thing that is. I was lucky enough to get a phone call from a friend of a friend who's in jail, and basically said, I believe in Jesus, I'd like to be baptized. And I'm like, that's awesome, like, great, good for you. I'm all on board, baptism is great. But I'd really like to hang out with you.
Yeah.
And I'd really like it. So, and I'm like, just so you know, there's plenty of churches that would love this.
Uh-huh.
They baptize you, and you're saved, and then you go, and then we've won, and then it's another life for the kingdom kind of
right.
thing.
But good I'm for actually, the stats, yeah. dollar to ratio convert
yeah, exactly.
level.
And,
yeah.
and right now, we've performed zero baptisms at my church this year, so I don't know. That means we're like, our dollar to baptism ratio yeah. is infinite in the wrong direction.
Right.
And maybe because, I again, this focus on relationship and what he said there. Have you seen this? I get adverts for it that, you know, the kind of conversations that you can have online with people. And I'm delighted that we can have those conversations. But one of the things they advertise is like, we get like one conversion per $11 or something.
Yeah.
I'm just like, that's
weird.
A very odd way of looking about
yeah.
things.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. No offense, Stephen. I know Stephen's one of those guys that answers the, you know, that talks to the people.
I like people talking to them.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with the conversation.
I think it's really like, it's more of a value. Like, it's more just of like, even how we present our values and even it, more than just like, we do need to pay the bills. We need donations. Yeah. We need all that. We need yeah, to be effective. Sure. But it's like the effectiveness of the pragmatism over the relationship is the problem. Then yeah. we're idealizing the wrong value system.
Mm.
And anyone who has hung out with Indigenous, if you have Indigenous friends or Indigenous people, they prioritize relationships even still over functional. And I remember way, way back having a really good friend and saying to her, like she was going to go into training to be a ministry leader. And I remember I had to repent for this later, but I remember saying to her at the time, like, you're going to have to figure out how to show up on time. Like, cause you know, and then when I found out why she wasn't on time, it was like, literally she was helping a poor person with groceries or something. And I had to go back and say like, actually, I think your value system is much more like Jesus.
Please
and I am the problem.
And help poor
That's
people.
Right. And forget I said any of that. And if people can't deal with it, then too bad for them. So again, it's just this cultural, like that value system's a more kingdom-like value system than mine. And the idea is that like I somehow, because of the superiority-ness of my whiteness and the confusion that culture is somehow biblical, which is bizarre, but true. I sort of say like, this is what you have to learn, instead of humbling myself to say, can you teach me how to do that? Like, can you teach me how to prioritize people over function?
I'm also straight feeling uncomfortable because in my head I'm like, but they still have to be up on time though. Like, no, that's
right.
not the point.
It's not the point. Exactly. And that's the same with the dollar to ratio.
Yeah,
like you still have to pay the bill. That's like, I'm so like, people still have to pay. And you're just like, but that's not the point. Like
yeah.
the point is that people are not equated to money ever and never, ever should be. And and there's some other, and he talks a lot. So his critique, his prophetic critique, is that there's no real, truly Indigenous church movement that occurs within the socio-cultural, ceremonial, religious life ways of the community. Right. That even to this day, Indigenous people are having to choose between their culture and Christianity, as though that's they're being forked.
Oh, there you go. Well done.
Right? Just to tie that back.
You were paying attention.
But then he says, this is interesting. He says, the mixing of Euro-American culture with the gospel, from Plato to Andrew Jackson to Ronald Reagan, is considered permissible and orthodox.
Mm.
So you can't culturalize our yeah. context and culture, but you can contextualize yours. And, you yeah. know, I talk a lot to people just about like Christmas trees and they say, you know, this religion's pagan. And I was like, oh, so you don't have a Christmas tree because we all know they're pagan. And they're like, what? And I was like, oh, so you're obviously mixing your Christianity with paganism if you have a Christmas tree. And then, you know, then my husband's like, yes, let's get rid of the Christmas tree. And I'm like, no, you're missing the point.
He's very happy to go for a strip down.
That's Christmas right. No meal. Christmas trees for him. Just like Jesus in a manger or something. I don't know. But anyway, no offense. I love you, honey. But the point is this. The contextualization of the gospel is the whole point of the incarnation. Like it's the Jesus contextualized himself into an actual people and a place and a into ceremony, like even Jewish tradition. That if you don't know about some of those Jewish ceremonies, even some of what Jesus says in the gospels, you don't understand because it's so contextualized into that concept of that into that culture. And that's the point.
I think this is one of the dangers as well. And again, I have a lot of time for people that want to spend time in their room reading scripture. That's good. That's beautiful. Don't ever stop doing that. I do that all the time.
Right.
But understanding, and I realize there are lots of commentaries and lots of people have lots of different opinions, but even just understanding history in terms of, well, I've been fishing before. Like that's a thing I've done, I guess. And so when I read about these men as fishermen, I'm like, I believe I can empathize with these people completely because they fish and I fish. And there we go. We have these two things in common.
Right.
But actually, I went on my friend's fancy boat on the Great Barrier Reef and it was super safe. And we had all this like technology telling us where fish was.
You also, went fishing on the Great Barrier Reef?
Yeah, man, that was pretty cool.
I thought that was a nature preserve. I didn't think you were allowed.
You're only allowed to catch certain things. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff there.
That's hilarious. And there's a lot. I've been, I took my eldest son on his first snorkeling experience at the Great Barrier Reef.
Yeah, so he's kind of into the mountaintop.
He was so overwhelmed because it's intense. Guys, like there's these big giant clams on the bottom, like, and he was just like, they're gonna eat me. And I was just like, suck it up, buddy. We're at the Great Barrier Reef.
You're
like,
gonna enjoy this.
Yes. Anyway, I digress. Go ahead. I mean, who has that fishing story that I went fishing at the Great Barrier Reef?
Well, I mean, it goes off like 200 kilometers, right? That's,
yeah.
So okay. Not all of it.
Yeah. I thought this was going to be in a pond in England somewhere, yeah. And then it just turned into an epic fishing adventure, which is even more of our point.
Yeah, exactly, right? So this one time went and...
in Australia to the Great Barrier Reef.
And I caught a fish, and then my brother-in-law, I freaked out because the... fish move a lot when you catch them out of the water.
Slimy,
weirdly, they're not
fight.
Into it. So I had to like hand that over to my brother-in-law. I couldn't deal with that.
Yeah.
And I'm not enough of a man. We'll get onto that later. But to say that like my experience of fishing gives me like much insight, it just doesn't. And the difference is there's some things that come up in scripture that, for example, we don't know any Samaritans. There are still some Samaritans around, but we don't probably know any personally. There's a good chance if you're listening. So we then have to go, okay, well, tell me about Samaritans. Tell me about the history of Samaria. What does this mean
for the story to make sense?
I have to like really dig in there. But for the things I'm like, I have been to a house and it shared a meal with someone. So but I'm not understanding the context. Mm-hmm. We miss so much, I think. And this is what Twist is saying. Like we're happy to contextualize ourselves and we're happy to accept that Jesus heavily contextualized his teaching. Again, if Jesus had told a story about saying, if you have a cell phone, and they're like, what are you talking about? Like, I don't know. This doesn't help me at all.
Right.
He's using the pieces of the world around them.
Yeah, like we've heard, I if you haven't heard, there's famous like missional content contextualization stories of like cultures where the words of Jesus have been translated because their center of being is not the heart, it's the throat.
Yeah.
I can't remember what that tribe is. And so it's like, when Jesus is talking about the heart, it's translated as throat. Because if he said heart, it would be like us saying throat. And we'd just be like, what? So it's contextualization is a basic principle. We just couldn't figure out how to do it and still can't figure out how to do it. And I think it has to do with the justice conversation around you have to dehumanize people in order to treat them badly. So I think part of why we couldn't do it here is because we couldn't do it here. Otherwise, we couldn't have taken the land, stolen the children, the work. You know, like, I feel like that's part of the answer. Yeah. He does get there a little bit. But let me just read another little section from this book, Colonization, Evangelization, and Assimilation. So the history of mission outreach to Native North American people is a story that ranges from dismal failure causing extreme grief to bright possibilities of hope for the future. There was potential in that the people had a prevalent belief and faith in a monotheistic creator. The Spirit of the Lord was already here, revealing the creator of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to them. If there is only one creator of this earth and this one humanity, why is there such gross failure to recognize the pervasive presence of creator, regardless of time and space, among biblically informed followers of the ways of Jesus? Sadly, many missionaries from the past couldn't see the people they were sent to serve as fellow children of Creator, created in His image and precious in His sight. Their perception was obscured by their worldview. And I think that kind of just goes to that that idea that if you don't see people as children of God who are genuinely seeking, if you can't see that, then you're never going to be able to contextualize the good news, whether that's your neighbor or like a people you don't like, you know, or whether that's like the farthest reaches of the world or different cultures than us. Like, we've got to see people differently.
When we don't see people as image bearers, as you say, then there's no desire or interest. Like, why would I try and treat you well because I don't see you as one bearing God's image? And that's why we need to start from there. I know we talked about this on the last series a lot, but the idea that humanity is good. Why? Because God says so.
Yes.
Like, and so if we begin in Genesis 1 and look at everyone and say, you are very good because you are created in the image and likeness of God and He calls you very good.
Yes.
Why don't we start there? Let's just start there. And if those folks had started there, I dare say things would look a whole lot better for a whole lot of people.
And I just want to end with this one quote, because one of the reasons why I've added him to Current Prophet is obviously like an indigenous voice talking theology it to this cultural moment is a prophet. And this was like before, like this book was written before that. But anyway, and then also here's a section of liberation. And I love this book because he's so hopeful. And I think that's one of a prophet's job is to actually speak hope, but like true hope into this current moment. So he says, more than reciting thick narrative or coded data, I'm telling these stories as a Lakota follower of the Jesus Way in the hope that they can serve to deconstruct and belie the American missionary government and lately conservative evangelical myths about our history and identity. Now, here's the part I want you to hear. Furthermore, and perhaps more importantly, I am especially hopeful that on the redemptive side of the deconstruction equation, this book can and will contribute to the integration of First Nations worldview perspectives and the theological curriculum of North America and beyond. The retelling of our history reorientates it from a story of colonization to the liberation of people in the light of Jesus coming among us. And I love that hopefulness, like just even that phrase, on the redemptive side of the deconstruction equation. I'm like, oh yes, please. And I don't know that I've met anyone that's not deconstructing. And yeah. I think it's one of the most beautiful things, except if we don't get to the redemptive side. So I think like, just know that if you are deconstructing and sort of these horrific understandings of what terrible theology and practice has done and is still doing. Yeah, then you're going to deconstruct hopefully the right things. But there is a redemptive side to deconstruction. The Lord is undoing things that are unnecessary. I feel like the word God's given me lately is just that Hebrews 12, that everything will be shaken that can be shaken in order to reveal the one thing that cannot be shaken. And I think like that's the deconstruction is to reveal the one thing that doesn't need to be deconstructed, which is Christ among us, which is Jesus. So, I mean, thank you, Dr. Richard Twist, for writing this book and living a beautiful life of redeeming deconstruction. So some more books for your library, guys.
Add them to the pile.
If you haven't taken part of the Christmas challenge, it's like 8,000 people in 90 other churches. That's really cool. It's been a really great, wonderful time of people seeking Jesus together during December and practicing the ways of infinitum. So
lots of Jesus.
Yeah, Jesus centering. Yeah, this is a decentering, decolonizing and deconstructing time. And so we got to reveal the thing that needs to be revealed, which is Jesus. If you don't know that, you should know that. And so check out infinitumlife.com. We do have these open prayer days. If you don't know about them, they're the second Wednesday of every month. And we just get together on Zoom. We start the day off and then you get a prayer guide and you pray. We had one of those just yesterday and it was... whew, it was amazing. It was art. It was featuring the work of Betty Dickinson, and she led us in all these Lectio Visio, using art to see into kingdom truths and scriptures. It was amazing. So every month it's different. Someone else leads and it's got a different prayer guide, and there's all these different kind of strategies you can use for the day, but also for the month. And that's a growing, beautiful global community. I think we had 12 countries on yesterday.
Cool.
From about 50 people, 12 countries. So anyway, it's kind of cool. It's a real global community. You get to meet some people you don't know from around the world who are trying also to follow Jesus, and it's growing into a beautiful thing. So if that's something that might help you, even if you want to come one time just to see what we do and maybe replicate that where you are, here's what I've determined this week in my life. We need more prayer.